This is 89.9 WWNO. I'm Janae Pierre, and it's time for All Things New Orleans. On today's show, we'll chat with the CEO of Inspire NOLA Charter Schools about their new program, Project Live and Achieve. Then we'll speak with author Jack Sullivan about his latest book, New Orleans Remix. That's all coming up on All Things New Orleans. But first, here's one of NOLA Life Stories. During the Vietnam War, New Orleans became a safe haven for scores of refugees fleeing the communist regime. The Historic New Orleans Collection has been collecting oral histories from many of these new Americans. Community leader Tony Tran was one of these individuals. He tells us about coming of age during the rise of the Viet Cong and his long journey to New Orleans in this edition of NOLA Life Stories.
As any citizen of Vietnam, we all experience the war because we live in the war. In front of my house, there was a huge shell flewing over and barely halfway. The shell was as big as my arms wrap around, and it didn't explode. So it stayed there every day. I touched the bottom of that shell. Now thinking about that, I was afraid because, you know, if you touch some part of that, it might explode and you know, the entire town will blow up. But you see, wartime is everywhere in the country, and you face with that every day. When they capture 50 of us, they tied us up, hand in the back. And so they put all of us into concentration camp. And 50 of us were there in a very little shed. It's like an open shed. So 50 of us can't fit in one shed. So some of us have to sleep outside the shed, facing the sky. And so it's a horrible time for almost a year after they see that keeping all of us in the group like that, it's a hassle to them, and so they release us. My brother and sister left Vietnam in 1975. I stayed back with the communists until 1979. I left Vietnam after 8 different tries to escape Vietnam, you know, facing the prison, so I know exactly how it's like. And so after 8 different tries, the 9th one is a successful one. When you are on the raft, escaping the country, it's another feeling of, you know, relief. But then, at the same time, the worry, because you don't have any clue of where to go. I pulled up, you know, all of what I have learned in school, imagining I just used the piece of chalk and draw a map of Vietnam on a sheet of metal of the raft, and imagining we are here traveling westward. That's where we're going to end up, either Thailand or Malaysia or somewhere. And we look at the sun as our direction or the star at night.
Authorities in Malaysia have towed another boat of Vietnamese refugees out to sea. It's the third boat in 2 days that's been set adrift. And like the others, it's unseaworthy and overcrowded. Many of those inside the camps would like to come to this country. But as Jim Lowry reports, they would probably...
Arriving onto the airport of Oakland, I saw cars parked all around the airport. And I say, what on earth? This is, you know, heaven. You see lights, street lights, airport lights. Up until this day, I still have that fantasy, you know, in the imagination of luxury life, of heavenly life. And so that was the impression up until this day. I have never forgot.
This NOLA Life Stories interview was conducted by Mark Kay for the Historic New Orleans Collection and later produced for WWNO by Sarah Holtz. This week, Inspire NOLA Charter Schools launched a new initiative bringing schools and community groups together to combat youth violence in New Orleans. Here to talk more about Project Live and Achieve is Jamar McNeely, CEO of Inspire NOLA Charter Schools. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So let's begin by talking about the background and the purpose behind Project Live and Achieve.
January 2007, in Inspire NOLA, we had a very unfortunate incident. One of our students was tragically shot and killed on one of our campuses at a basketball game. And that has pretty much stuck with me not only this year, but every single year. I can recall certain things that has happened in New Orleans community that has been unfortunate to some of the students that I had the opportunity to teach. So this initiative came about not only from the incident last year, but in previous before, like I mentioned, on what we're going to do as an organization, try to change the landscape for our youth in New Orleans. Too often we see on our news and our radio stations unfortunate things that are happening, that this initiative is designed to do two things. Not only to decrease the crime and the violence of our youth, but also promote higher academic outcomes where our students can have a positive future and some better outcomes for their life.
Absolutely. I recall that that incident last year that happened at Etna Carr High School, correct?
Correct.
And the young man, he was a graduate.
He was a graduate, had just graduated. But the thing that stuck with me even more than just the unfortunate situation, we had a meeting with our student council. And our student council was asking questions like, will I be safe to come to school? Why is this happening in New Orleans? What are we going to do in our community to change the landscape? Some of you were saying, you know, unfortunately, too many of them in their neighborhoods have seen the same type of incident, and they wanted something different. They're asking, how can I get to college where I can just get away from these type of situations? So we decided to take a stand 1 year later and just say, you know what? We're going to try to rally around our youth and do something positive to change negative situations to something positive and just rally for our children to actually do some great things.
And again, the main goal is to decrease crime for New Orleans youth, but also to strive for higher academic excellence. Let's talk about how the two go hand in hand.
Well, hopefully the crime, if you look at some of the statistics, 99% of our juveniles arrested in our city are African American. But if you look at statistics and median income, you see that the more kids actually graduate from high school and graduate from college, that their median income actually increases. So for us, it's a combination. Not only can we educate our students to be positive citizens, we can send them on a pathway where they can actually do great things for their families and their legacy that they're leaving behind by actually providing that median income and actually being able to thrive in a working environment.
So this is a year-long program. This isn't just one day, one weekend, one workshop. This is a year-long program. Let's talk about some of the main components.
It's a year-long program to expose our youth of New Orleans to some great things. On February 2nd, we have a great rally, as well as a very special guest, Bernice King, as our keynote speaker as we approach the anniversary of the Martin Luther King assassination. We will rally our students around doing some great things. We'll have some bands in attendance because you know we're in New Orleans, so it's important to make the New Orleans spirit connect.
Yeah.
But year-long, we're going to have everything from conflict resolution workshops, a day of service, student panel discussions on achievement and violence. We'll have some open gyms. We'll do night out against crime. We'll have some debate clubs, quiz bowls, everything to just make education fun again and cool for our kids, as well as doing different things to deter them away from violence.
And that's also something that Inspire NOLA Charter Schools aim to do, is to actually make school fun again, right?
You know, the way that I see it, the whole theme of our organization, the name Inspire NOLA Charter School, says that our mission is to inspire. We can easily say that we want to inspire the mind, but for us, we also like to inspire the heart. And when you do the combination of both, it really thrives to something positive.
You mentioned your upcoming Rally for Excellence, which features keynote speaker Dr. Bernice King. And I know you had a huge list of people that you could have chosen from, but why Dr. King and why at this time?
Well, as we just closed out MLK Day, and as we approach the 50th year anniversary of the assassination, Dr. Bernice King has just been doing some very positive things in the community. When you research her in Atlanta and with the King Center, you just see how she's definitely a pillar when it comes to education for our youth. I thought it would be a great connection to really have someone that can inspire our students, one who can talk about the dream and what that was for us, and one who can just really make a connection community-wise on how we can build together.
As we're talking about this Rally for Excellence, what are your expectations as far as what the students take away and what they bring back to their communities?
Well, this would be the first event that we're having with the Project Live and Achieve initiative. I'm hoping that the students, not only with Dr. King, but with Angela Yee, understand the connection of what we can do together, to understand that education is a way out, to understand that education is a cool thing to really try to thrive and do, but also to understand that it's important that each and every one of our students continue to live. It's important that we change the dynamic of the rates around death, the rates around crime in our city, especially for our youth between the ages of 16 and 25, to really have some positive outcomes.
And again, this Rally for Excellence is happening Friday, February 2nd, 10 a.m. at Xavier University's Convocation Center.
Correct.
Besides keynote speaker Dr. Bernice King, who else will be there again?
Well, we're going to have a list of our community members in support of our youth. We're asking for the community to come out and just rally around our youth. Far too often, we just see political things, but we want them just to be there in support for our youth. We'll have U.S. Congressman Cedric Richmond actually speak to our kids. We'll have Mary-elect Latoya Cantrell. We have a whole list of sponsors and partners. We have 5,000 students coming throughout the city of New Orleans from various different schools just to hear a positive message and for us all to rally together. You know, it's important that a lot of people don't realize that a lot of our students come from the same communities. They're just wearing different uniforms. Mm-hmm. And it's important that we all be in one set and rallying around the same thing, which is education and nonviolence.
And with that said, this event is not just for students who are at an Inspire charter school.
This event is open to the public. One thing about New Orleans, far too often, if it's not a concert or a festival, we don't have the opportunity to really engage in an intellectual conversation. Mm-hmm. Dr. Bernice King, this is a one-in-a-lifetime opportunity where she's coming for free. For the public to actually come out and be a part of this wonderful rally. So we definitely encourage the public to come out and be in support of our youth as we try to do some positive things.
That was Jamar McNeely, CEO of Inspire NOLA Charter Schools. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
To learn more about Project Live and Achieve, visit InspireNOLAChartersSchools.org. Author Jack Sullivan's latest book examines the city's greatest musical renaissance since Louis Armstrong. The book entitled New Orleans Remix highlights some of the city's beloved musicians. Here to tell us all about New Orleans Remix is author Jack Sullivan. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
So you've been writing music essays and books for some time now, but never a complete book with a focus on one city's music scene. What makes the New Orleans music scene unique to you?
Well, I came down to New Orleans years ago for my brother's wedding in the early 80s, and I thought jazz was what I hear in New York, which is this very abstract, polite thing where people sit like they're in a graduate seminar and listen dutifully and applaud at people's solos, and that's it. So I came to New Orleans and heard the Preservation Hall Band in the hall, and it just kind of blew me away. It was my jazz epiphany, and it changed my mind about what jazz was. Mm-hmm. And I loved everything about the city, and I started coming down a lot in the 80s. And in 1990, I concocted a student trip, American Studies class, a credit-bearing class called New Orleans, and I've been leading the group down ever since. So I come down with them in January. And I come down by myself as often as I can as well.
Right, right. Now, you mentioned your love for jazz, and jazz is the focus of your latest book. But how do you complete the picture of the entire music scene in New Orleans within one book?
Well, what I tried to do was focus on what's been happening since the 1990s, because it seemed to me that things started really changing then in all sorts of ways. You had the brass band renaissance, you had the new visibility of the Mardi Gras Indians, you had the beginning of a new wave of female horn players, you had, of course, all the new forms of hip-hop and other very contemporary things, you had a lot of klezmer music. A lot of things started happening that are still happening that were just there sporadically on the scene before. And a couple of the musicians, Jason Marsalis most notably, confirmed to me that 1990 or 91 or 92 was really when things started changing. And so I was just kind of lucky, because that's when I first started coming down on a very regular basis. It just, the two things just coincided for me.
Now, you just mentioned Jason Marsalis, and he's also featured in your book. And you spotlight some other artists, including Kermit Ruffins and John Batiste. How important is it for you to feature those artists in this book?
Well, it was easy to interview John Batiste because he lives in New York, and I live in New York, and I just went, got on the subway and met him at Juilliard. The others, at first, it was hard to get interviews, except with Kermit Ruffins, who was always incredibly affable and just loved to talk to me. The others, it just took a while. I would come down every year. The musicians started noticing me, and they especially noticed that I usually had 21 or 22-year-old people with me, some of whom were really, very good singers from the Westminster Choir College, and they would let them sit in. And so I kind of gained their trust, and they started telling other musicians about me as well. And right after the hurricane, I decided to make this into a book. I'd been collecting notes, not quite knowing what I would do with them for some time. I wrote a few articles. I did some short pieces on my experiences, but I decided right after the hurricane to really start interviewing in a serious, consistent way. And by that time, I had a lot of people who were really willing to talk to me, and they would in turn, as I say, tell other people about me. And a lot of the interviews were done at like 1 a.m. after people's gigs. Some musicians would invite me to their homes. Some were just kind of done on the go. But I got really lucky toward the end and got a big surge of interviews, and I was able to pull it all together.
And I imagine that it's so much that you pull together, because I was going to ask about your research and preparation before putting this book together. But how did you decide what to include and what not to include?
Well, you know, a lot of it's based on personal taste. It's very easy to find first-rate music in New Orleans, so I had to just exclude some things almost arbitrarily. I couldn't get everything in. But mainly it was the groups that I just found myself wanting to hear again and again. Somebody like Jason Marsalis, somebody like John Boutte. I fell in love with a group called the Brassaholics, one of the newer groups. I've always loved the Tuxedo Jazz Band. There are certain groups that just, they're either brand new and seem very exciting and important, or groups that have been around for a very long time, like Tuxedo has been around for over 100 years now. So it was a combination of groups that I think are cutting edge and I think will be around for a while, and groups that really have been around for a while that people don't know about enough. I mean, everybody knows who John Batiste is because of the Colbert Show. Not many people know who Leroy Jones is, who's a great jazz trumpeter. Mm-hmm. And I tried to get as many people in the book who are great musicians, who are working musicians, who have a reputation, but they're not celebrities, and they need to be more written about, it seems to me.
And again, the name of the book is New Orleans Remix. Let's talk about how you include insights into opera along with jazz and brass band music.
Well, my background is really in writing about classical music. I write program notes for the Metropolitan Opera and for Carnegie Hall, and so I didn't really know there was a great tie-in except for Louis Moreau Gottschalk. I've known about that for many years. And he's really America's first great, completely American pop star. I knew about him. He came before Dvorak, way before Copland or Gershwin or any of those other composers. But I didn't know how deeply connected opera was to the New Orleans jazz scene until I started talking to people, and I realized that people like John Boutte, Leroy Jones, a whole bunch of people really love classical music and are classically trained. And then I started hearing stories about Louis Armstrong warming up with Italian opera arias, and I interviewed a bunch of people, and it all turned out to be true. And of course, New Orleans has this amazing French opera scene that was the greatest opera scene in the New World for many, many years. And I don't think people really know about that, and I don't think they appreciate how much everything from Gottschalk to Italian opera has really influenced the jazz scene, but it has.
Now, you know, the music scene here in New Orleans is fairly special to everyone who's from here or not. Why do you think that musical fire still burns so fiercely here?
I think it's the city itself. I talk with a lot of musicians who talk about a special spiritual ambiance that you can just kind of feel. It's like an ineffable but very powerful aura that it reflects the presence of the ancestors, as the musicians put it. And it's a very real thing, and it's reflected in the traditions, in Mardi Gras, in the jazz bands that you constantly hear marching in the streets. And it's something that goes way back. And I read a lot of books that talked about numbers and stats and everything on the scene from a sociological perspective. I really did not want to do that. I wanted to do something from the musician's perspective, which is very different. It's what Michael White calls the presence of the ancestors. And so the word magic is actually used by the musicians frequently. Magic is ordinary, is what Todd Duke told me years ago. And so I wanted to do it from that perspective, because that is the perspective of the musicians themselves. That's what makes the city so special. There's a kind of magic ambiance. There's a laid-backness. People talk about it, but you really have to experience it. And I remember that James Evans, who is one of the many people I interviewed who came from somewhere else, he was from Wales, said when people hear the word laid back, they think it's a kind of lazy, sultry, kind of just cool thing. But it's actually, once you hear the music, it's incredibly intense. And so it's the combination of coolness and intensity that I think is so special, and I think it really comes from the city itself.
What are you hoping readers take away from your book?
Well, I hope they come to New Orleans, and I hope they realize that it's a very special place that needs to be nurtured, and that they will have an incredibly good time there. And if they go to the places that I try to point out in the book, they'll hear the real music. They won't just hear the tourist music, which is important, but is not what the real scene is about. And I hope they'll realize which New Orleans groups to go hear when they travel around the country, and indeed around the world, because ever since Hurricane Katrina, a lot of these groups come to New York regularly. And I know I was able to interview Alan Toussaint here in New York, because he was actually living in New York. A lot of people have, you know, two or three different homes now.
Yeah.
And so you can hear these musicians everywhere, but it's never as intense, never as improvisational, and never as special as when you hear them in New Orleans itself. So I encourage people to actually come down and hear the music, and not necessarily just at Jazz Fest or Mardi Gras, but during the off times when you can hear music in a very intimate way and hear the same musicians but not have to deal with crowds. My favorite time is January.
January, so you were just here.
Yes. Yes, you had to put up with it being 30 degrees and then 70 degrees, but other than that, it's a really great time to come down. It's the beginning of Mardi Gras, but it's not too crowded, not too crazy yet.
That was Jack Sullivan, author of New Orleans Remix. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
His latest book, New Orleans Remix, can be found wherever books are sold. It's that time of year again. It's carnival time. This Saturday, catch Crew de Vue in the French Quarter, followed by Crew Delusion. And on Sunday, don't miss the Crew of Little Rascals in Metairie. It's carnival season in the 504. Have fun and be safe. That's it for this week's edition of All Things New Orleans. I'm Janae Pierre. Follow me on Twitter at Miss Janae Pierre, and feel free to tweet comments or questions. Would you like to suggest a guest or topic? Send an email to janae@wwno.org. That's J-A-N-A-E at wwno.org. Visit our website to check out previous shows, and be sure to catch us next week, right here on 89.9 WWNO New Orleans and 90.5 KTLN Thibodaux Houma. Thanks for joining us.